I mean, that darn Google toolbar.
There you go.
Which one of these is my water?
The empty one is mine. So.
Okay.
All set? Okay. I guess we're ready. Okay. So this is part six, which I guess thankfully is the last part. Thanks, everybody, for hanging in for the day. We're going to run through this, and then I guess we're going to have some kind of goodie raffle at the end, I'm sure, where all kinds of wonderful things will be given away. So this is writing testable maintainable apps with Entity Framework. So we've seen a lot of different changes in Entity Framework 1 versus 4 today, and also looked at other ways of doing things that Entity Framework 4 now makes possible. So we're going to kind of sort of put all that together in a little pair demo here. I'm going to speak a little bit, and Julie's going to type, but she's probably better at typing than I am, those of you who've seen me code live.
So at this point in the day, I'm better at typing than speaking.
So let's see if we can run through a little bit of slides here before we get into some code. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at a little bit of refactoring. We're going to take an application. I believe it's an MVC app, right? Yes, an MVC app, and we're going to refactor it. And then in order to make it testable, and then we're going to look at a little bit more complex solution that has already been refactored and already has some things going on that Julie's going to sort of take us a tour through. So why do we care about this in the first place, right? So ultimately, what this all comes down to is achieving what I like to refer to as the illities, right? So who in the room has heard of the illities? Anybody? No? Okay, a couple of you. So here's an illity, extensibility, right? So this basically means that the code we're going to write is going to make it easy for us to extend it in the future. Another one of the important illities is adaptability. So the difference here between extensibility and adaptability is extensibility is we planned for it, right? We intended for this part of the code to be extensible and this part of the solution to expand in this direction. Adaptability is our ability to respond to change, so we didn't expect the change to happen in quite the way it ended up happening for us. Testability is that ability of us, obviously, to write testable code. So how many people in this room write unit tests? Okay, fair number of you, right? I assume the rest of you are what, crossing your fingers? Okay. So the bottom line is, right, as anybody who writes software for a living knows, it turns out that for those of you that didn't raise your hands saying you're doing unit testing, right, you're actually doing testing anyway. Right, you're doing what I call F5 testing. It's F5 and click, and click, and click, and click some more, and probably even click some more, right? The bottom line is that as software professionals, you're probably doing testing. The only real question is whether or not it's automated or manual, right? Otherwise, you're just crossing your fingers and hoping, and as we're all professionals, hopefully nobody's doing that. And maintainability is this notion, of course, that we can maintain the code over time. We saw some hands earlier about those people working on greenfield projects versus those people maintaining existing systems. Eventually, even the best greenfield software solution eventually becomes brownfield, right? Or it gets folded up and never used again, which is a general failure, right? But all the code, even the new solutions, are eventually going to become those things that need to be maintained. And so ensuring that code we're writing is maintainable is important for us. So this is another illity that we don't usually talk about, right? This one is quality. And this gets to the idea that a lot of people say, and this kind of goes back to one of the questions that was asked earlier, why would I care about all this POCO stuff, right? Why wouldn't I just inherit from entity object, right? Well, imagine that it's 2002, and you've just written a whole bunch of business logic and wrapped it up into a class, and it all inherits from data set. Now, with hindsight, that seems like a bad choice because we don't typically like to use data sets anymore, and they've generally been deprecated, and they're still supported, but generally speaking, they're not the preferred way of doing things. In another 10 years, I doubt rather seriously whether entity object will be the preferred way of doing things, right? So what we look to is we look to the idea of being able to separate the code that we write from the code others write, the things that encapsulates our value from the things that encapsulates the value other people have written. So we look at things like POCO, right, and the ability to have our separated concerns and focus in on putting our core business logic in classes that are not, let's say, polluted, right, it's a bad term, but are not affected or influenced in many ways by other framework concerns, right? So we talk about persistence ignorance as being this important thing. The truth is, what we really mean is not just persistence ignorance, although that's the place where it most commonly manifests itself. We also think about infrastructure ignorance, right? Not just persistence, but other infrastructure concerns too. Because the one thing we know is that the rate at which our infrastructure is going to change is going to be very different from the rate at which our business rules are going to change. Right? Those things are going to change for two very different reasons, probably more than two, right? But also two very different timelines, right? We know, for example, that the .NET framework won't change until the next version of the .NET framework is released. We know that when that happens, Microsoft is going to do that with an eye towards pretty strong influence on reverse compatibility, because that's an important value to them. But your business isn't going to look at the business rules and say, you know, we should make sure that the next time we change our business rules, we're also going on ahead and making sure that we have reverse compatibility with all the existing software in our enterprise. That's just not something that happens, right? Those two things change for different reasons. So whenever you have things in your software solution that are influenced by different factors, change on different timelines,
she's being naughty.
I'm trying to get people to throw ninja heads at you. So
awesome.
You can't blame me.
I'm looking at you, Rachel. All right. So anytime you have in your software solution, right, things that change for different reasons, we want to go on ahead and encapsulate those things in different areas of the software. We do that typically by using abstractions. Right? We want to make sure that change in one area for one reason doesn't influence the other parts of the software system. So these are the kinds of reasons why this matters. Which, of course, is why you should care about this, right? So persistence ignorance you already talked about. And this is about future-proofing your investment, right? The code you're writing today, you want to be able to maintain and extend and adapt for all the reasons that make business value for you, right? Not reasons that make changes for persistence reasons. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at code that's going to leverage a couple of different abstractions here. So one of the important abstractions that came along in Entity Framework 4 is we have this object set, which represents our collection of objects that are persisted. We thankfully have granted to us this iObjectSet interface. Right, what's the difference here? The difference is that ObjectSet itself, ultimately, if you go bother to look at its entire inheritance chain, includes things like object query and all kinds of other things that are very specific to Entity Framework, and therefore implementations that are very specific to Entity Framework. So trying to test with object sets is somewhat difficult because there's infrastructure concerns that object set expects to be present when you start using object set. Right? It's looking for that data context. It's looking for other things. However, iObjectSet, this interface, obviously doesn't contain any implementations with it, right? Interface is just a description of the contract. And so this contract is things like add, attach, delete, and so on. It's collection-specific behavior, but because it's an interface, for the sake of isolation, if we code to that, then we can provide our own implementations of iObjectSet when it comes time to do our testing, and we can disconnect ourselves from some of the infrastructure that's in Entity Framework when it comes time for us to do our testing. Obviously, as you can see, right, ObjectSet is a concrete class that implements iObjectSet and inherits from query, as I just said. And if you don't like the bullets, this is it in code. Sorry, I don't write VB anymore. I used to. My first couple of years in .NET were in VB.NET. So how does all this work, right? So the first thing we look at is the plain old CLR objects, our ability to write objects that are not tied to infrastructure concerns, specifically in the context of Entity Framework. They're not tied to persistence infrastructure concerns. We use the T4 code generation, which we've already seen some of today. We looked at various different templates, various different ways to control the templates, the different kinds of classes that can be generated. We're also going to look at disconnected methods. This is our ability to look at methods on our objects, which are not necessarily going to be tied to the persistence. And, of course, iObjectSet, as we just talked about a moment ago, is this infrastructure interface, which will allow us to decouple what we're coding from Entity Framework. So persistence ignorance and repositories. So we start out and we have our classes, right? We're going to go from perfect world to not quite so perfect world, right? We have our classes. And we have a collection of repositories. So this collection of repositories abstracts our data access methods. So things like update customer, add customer, these kinds of things are present in our repositories. We use them to encapsulate and abstract queries as well. In a perfect world, this is all we'd have. This is what we'd like to see, We'd like to just have a bunch of classes with some methods on them and behavior. We'd like to have some repositories that represent our data access interaction. However, one of the things we have a challenge with is that the way Entity Framework works is we have this entity data model in the object context that's how we relate these two things together. Obviously, that's infrastructure, right? But in the case of our running application, that's infrastructure that we obviously need. And ultimately, of course, this takes a dependency on system data entity and a bunch of other infrastructure concerns, right? So the right-hand side of this slide, represents our running application, right, and some of its dependencies. So when the application's really running, no problem in having these dependencies. We kind of expect them to be there, and it's okay to have them. We need them to actually do real work. But, and obviously the UI talks to the repositories and all the rest of that. However, one of the things that's important to understand is that in a very real sense, this diagram in and of itself as it exists right here is really not complete. And it's not complete because if we have repositories that are specific to our classes, so for example, if we have one repository, the job is to abstract interacting with saving customers, and another one that's responsible for abstracting interacting with orders and those kinds of things, sometimes from our UI layer, we actually have the need to interact with several of those repositories at once in order to do real work, right? A very simplistic example is retrieve the customer, update it, push it back, but a more complex example is retrieve the customer, place several orders, maybe change an address or six. All kinds of different behaviors are going on in a real complex business scenario other than just retrieve, edit, save, right? That's an easy example to use, but the truth is most business rules are more complicated than that. And so what we try to do is we try to encapsulate our repository interaction from our UI in this idea of unit of work. So unit of work is a pattern, more than anything else, that is designed to provide what we like to refer to as sort of a business-level transaction. Right, we're all familiar with transactions in the database. That's not a unit of work necessarily. Okay? A transaction in the database is designed to provide a single atomic interaction with the database. Unit of work in our application is designed to abstract away a single atomic business operation, right? So, for example, we might end up in a situation where what we want to do is place an order, right? Customer places an order, and we want to decrement the inventory number for that particular item, as an example. Okay, those are two different tables. They may even be two different databases, for all we know, right? But in a general sense, right, they're all part of the same unit of work. So we want to either commit them atomically or not. Right? And this unit of work idea is about, and that's why we say business transaction, right? That entire business transaction will either succeed or that entire business transaction will fail. Right? And that's the notion of unit of work. It's not, it can be thought of like a database transaction, but it is not one-to-one with database transactions. Typically, you'll see in many cases in complex applications, the unit of work is one-to-many with database transactions. So we also want to write tests. So we have this other thing, and the reason it's down here, much like the UI, right, is that these tests also want to interact with our repositories for the sake of doing our unit testing. However, we need to do something about how the repositories talk to the classes. And so the way we do that in the context of Entity Framework is we look at our ability to produce fake data context. Okay? Just like there's an interface on iObjectSet, there are interfaces on the data context. This gives us our ability to sort of fake these things out, provide fake contexts that don't really talk to the database, but have behaviors that we want specifically for the context of our testing. Okay? And ultimately, what we end up with here is a fake object set, right, which is intended to sort of play the same place in the diagram as the system entity data, because system data entity is where the real object set comes from, and our fake object set is going to sort of be the stand-in there, right? So what you have here in this diagram is essentially two different use cases for our code. In one case, our code is really using the entity data model. It's really using a real object context. It's really using a dependency on system entity data, and it's really being used through the user interface probably in this scenario. On the other half of the slide, what we have is the testing scenario where we've taken the dependencies that are on the database and the fake, the actual data context and the actual object set, and we replace them with stand-ins. We replace them with fakes. They don't have no behavior, right, but they have behavior we want to be in charge of. Okay, so it's possible for us to essentially take the repository and not have it be aware, of whether it's talking to a fake data context or a real object context. Right? And we do that because the repository is coded ultimately to deal with interfaces. And at runtime, we substitute for the interface an actual implementation that has real behavior and talks to the database. And at test time, we do that same substitution, but we replace it with implementations of interfaces that do not actually talk to the database. So we don't have that dependency. So it allows us to isolate all of this system in the sake of the testing, right? And hopefully everything goes green. And now we actually need to back up, right? Because it's time for you, Julie.
So we're Pinky in the brain now. He's the brain. I'm just Pinky the coder. What I'm going to do, I'm going to do the code now, and I'm going to do two things. First, I'm going to open up a really simplistic MVC application that is written kind of like the basic way we see them with a typical demo. And I'm going to refactor that as we create some repositories and build in some of the stuff that Steve was talking about. While I'm doing that, I won't be building out the entire infrastructure. It's a lot to do. So for that scenario, it's just really to help people kind of see, as you watch the refactoring happen and watch this application evolve, give you the idea, the understanding of what these different pieces are. It's really, really geared towards people who've never done repositories before. Like I had not before I really embarked on all this about a year ago. Then what I'm going to do is open up a bigger application that has all of this implementation in it and just show you some different pieces of it and some of the benefits, especially when we get into doing the testing where some of this really shines. And obviously, you know, we could spend a lot of time doing that. So I'm just going to give you a quick look at that. You'll have access to these projects, these solutions after the fact. So the first application is pretty simple. I'll just run it to begin with. And this is just a little simple MVC application. And if you've never used MVC, don't worry about MVC. It's just a way of getting some data out on the screen so you can see it being used. So here's just a little application that shows some, we're back to talks. And this time talks with their speakers. So it shows the talks and speakers. So it's some related data in an entity framework model, an entity data model. I keep looking up here, which is what's giving me the headache with my poor eyeballs. So the way this is working is in entity framework, you have a model, MVC, model view controller. Okay, so the controller interacts between the model and the view. The view is, you know, your ASPX pages. They don't work the same as in a web forms, but they are indeed ASPX pages. So in the controller, this is where we can get the information that's going to go into the view. So I'm spinning up a context. And then I'm saying, give me the talks and pass them into the view. In this case, the view is going to be the index view because that's the method I'm in. Okay? So the problem, so that's what we've got. It's just, you know, really, really simple stuff. And the problem for me is that I've got the context buried pretty deeply into this application, and I don't want to. At the level of the controller, I really don't want the controller to have to know how all of my data access is working. That, you know, the controller is now completely dependent on the entity framework. It's dependent on the object context. So my goal is to remove that dependency. All right? So I'm working with, and again, this is a really, really simple setup, not really professionally architected. I've got a very, very simple model. I'm just using the default code gen, so you can see I've got that code behind there for the model. And The first thing I want to do is, and I'm just going to do this by uncommenting stuff just for the sake of time. I'm going to go, I've already created some templates. I've just got them excluded from the project. So I'm going to turn off the code generation for this model. So I'm just going to set that to none, the code generation strategy to none, and I'll include these two template, these two T4 template files, which now will go ahead and generate things. Now, this is just using the defaults for the POCO templates. Okay, so I'm getting POCOs now. So this is first. My first step is I'm going to get rid of the entity objects and use POCOs. I haven't made any modifications to the T4 templates. These are the straight T4 templates as I download them from the intranet. So you don't have to do anything special in that light. When I made modifications in the last presentation, that's because I was making modifications so for specifically using them with WCF the way I wanted them to be. So I'm not doing that here. These are just right out of the box with that template. So now I should be able to go ahead and still run this, but now I'm going to be, I should be. Got something. Oh, it's got a change in it that shouldn't be in there yet. That's funny. And I want to actually have that backward error to prove a point to you. Where's the other one? Search. Okay. So like I said, it should just work because all I've done was switch from my entity objects to my POCOs. Okay? So now I'm just using the POCOs. But I'm still working with an application that has a total dependency on my context. Okay? So the next thing I want to do is start using the repositories that Steve was working with. And again, the repositories are like little data access layers for me. All right? So rather than working directly with the object context, I'm going to have my controller work with these repositories. And again, for the sake of time, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to, I've got this stuff already written. So I'm going to start with these repository classes. Oh, this was switching. Oh, wrong one. That's why it's named repository. So here, this is a simple repository. And there's a ton of ways you can architect repositories. Right. This is just, you know, just getting it out there. There are people who will create repositories for each class that they want to wrap data access in. But not everybody does it that way, right? You might do it more kind of domain-based repositories. Mm-hmm. So you must have those kinds of conversations a lot. Are they polite conversations?
No, they're very good conversations. But the notion behind the repository pattern goes back to an idea that in your application there are some classes that are okay to access directly, and there are some classes that should really only be accessed through other classes. So, for example, while it might be reasonable for a customer to place an order, it's not reasonable for you to just go new order in the middle of nowhere. right? It's maybe also not necessarily reasonable for you to query an order directly out of the database unless it's already associated with a customer. So when you start to look at complex object models, part of the goal of the repository pattern is to identify those objects that in the terminology are typically referred to as aggregate roots. But their root, they really mean is these are the objects that hold references to other objects. Okay, so customers might hold references to orders. So in this particular case, rather than necessarily having a repository for customers and another one for orders, we might have a business rule that says we don't access orders except in the context of customers, which means that the way we get at orders is not by saying select star from the orders table, but we do so by retrieving the customer and interacting with its orders property. Now, I use customers and orders because that's a very simple relationship for people to understand, but one can imagine all kinds of relationships like this, right? And so if you have a data access strategy that says it's okay for any developer to access any object in any situation they want to in order to do anything they want to with it, you're going to rapidly end up with chaos in complex models. So the notion of the repository is that it, first of all, abstracts your data access away from your application. So it represents a layer of data access that you can see, right, starts to have methods that don't just have, you know, select and so on, but actually have ultimately methods with business meaning. So we might say, for example, right, when you actually do the query, you might say select all customers where customer status is silver, for example. But the repository method that allows you access to that query is ultimately going to have some kind of business meaning. Right? So we're going to be able to name things, name methods on our repository in terms of the business context. So the idea behind the repository in general is not just that it abstracts data access, but also that it allows you to set up basically these are sort of the gate points into my object model. I'm not going to be able to just select any object I feel like anytime I want to. This is the way in which I'm going to go about performing those queries and the way in which I'm going to get to objects that are buried 3 and 4 layers deep in my object model.
And as somebody who is fairly new to doing this within the last year, one of the really interesting things that happened with me as I started trying to design these applications and figure out where things go, it really made me, it gave me a whole new perspective on designing my applications because I really started thinking about every little thing. Well, where does it really make sense for this bit of logic to go as I was starting to break things apart? Really, you know, just doing that, I think I really felt like it made me not just more aware, but it really brought my development skills to a new level because of that.
Right.
I feel like we're doing an infomercial.
Well, and yeah.
What do you think, Suzanne Summers?
Yeah, we got a free set of steak knives. I do think, right, that one of the things that's important about any pattern is that the pattern represents a set of guidance, right? It's not a set of rules, so there are good reasons to violate them in times, but like any good pattern, whether it's an object-oriented design pattern or a software organizational pattern like your repository pattern, it represents a set of best practice guidance. So it does help you very much answer the question, where does this go, right? So if you have fairly hard and fast rules about how objects are accessed, you have fairly hard and fast, like, for example, it becomes very easy when you're using things like repositories for you to, as a design team, as a development team on the project, decide once and for all what the scope of returning iQueryable really is permitted to be in this application, right? So we can have rules like no iQueryables get to bleed out of our repositories, for example. Or we can have rules like it's okay for every repository to return iQueryable, right? It's not a value decision about returning iQueryable. There are pros and cons to both approaches. But as soon as you start to draw boundary lines between parts of your application, it becomes very easy to direct these kinds of rules and practices across the entire project, and so you do get an increased consistency in the code you're writing.
So, back to my stupid simple application. So I created just two little bits of code here. One is so I can get all of the talks if I need them, and the other is I can get an explicit talk if I need to access that. Now, what I'm working with here is in order to do this, notice in my repository I have a context, right? I want to be able to define and execute a query. So I have a context. Now, I could just use an instance of my context, whatever it happens to be, same one that I'm using here, the conference entities context. I could put that right in my repository. But now the repository, the context the conference entities context inherits from object context and has all that tight binding now right back to the entity framework, right? So I don't want to put that in there. I need a context, but I don't want to use that object context. So what I've done instead was I've created an interface that that defines the same things I know that I need, right? The same things my context gives me, my object context gives me. It gives me talks, it gives me speakers, it gives me rooms. Notice, rather than using the concrete object set like I normally would, if you've, you know, we've looked into the entity classes before, it returns a concrete object set. You know, here, planning for all this separation and better architecture, I'm using an I object set. So again, I'm using an interface which gives me more flexibility down the road. I can use anything, I can return anything that inherits from I object set. Okay? I don't have to return I object set, but just as long as it's something that inherits from I object set, implements, excuse me, I object set, I'm good. So the same goes, now that I've created this context interface, the same goes in here, this context, it doesn't have to be an object context. It just has to be anything that is an I context, that implements an I context. So what I need to do, and this, again, well, this will change when we look at the more complex application. I'm going to pass in the context that I want to be used to execute these queries. Whatever type of I context is in the repository, it doesn't care, just as long as it implements I context. All right, it doesn't care if it's going to be an object system.data.object context or one of the fake contexts that you saw in the last diagram that Steve was showing you that also implements I context. So I've set the repository up to be really loose, right? So it really can go in a lot of directions. Or use things that come from a lot of directions.
Right, and this is that concept in object-oriented design, right, of the least derived type that satisfies the contract. Right, so if all we need inside the repository are the four methods that Julie defined on the interface, then there's no need to state the contract in terms of the gigantic object context with all of the rest of its methods. Yeah.
Oh, no, this is just, C-sharp syntax and extended. This is actually, well, it's my practice when I'm naming local variables. Oh, this here compared to this? Okay, this is a public property. The property is the uppercase. This local, this here is a local variable. So I'm... Yeah, so look, I'm defining that local variable, and then I'm setting it. But what I'm doing is I'm exposing it.
What is capital C and what is small c?
Right, the capital C is the name of the public property, right? This is the name of this public property with the getter and the setter. It returns the private field or it sets the value to the private field.
Right.
And this is the private field.
Okay, and up here, this context with the lowercase is the parameter argument to the constructor for the repository. Which, this one?
Yeah.
Right there. It's an I context.
Oh,
it's the parameter argument to the constructor.
This one here? Here, right.
Yeah, it's the parameter argument to the constructor, right? It is of type I context, which allows us to assign it to this field of type I context.
Charles, we can go over the syntax a little. We can go over the syntax later. All right, excellent. Believe me, when I was moving from VB to C-sharp, I had a lot of these same questions. So now what I want to do is go back over the home controller and say, okay, the controller no longer needs to know about that conference entities. Instead, what I want to do is create a new repository equals new, what did I call my repository? Repository?
Repository.
And then in order to ask the repository to The repository notice, it needs a parameter, which is the context. It needs my object. I need to put it, pass an object context into there so that it's able to call that query. Right, so that's the constructor. I need to take send the object context in there. So we'll take this. Well, I could actually just do it this way. Just instantiate it on the fly, my conference entities. New conference entities. Okay? I got a problem. Oh, one of the problems is no. Yeah, but I was expecting a problem also. Oh, I've got the friends now, Steve.
All right.
But I still have a problem. Okay, what's the problem? The problem is it's expecting an I context, but conference entities is an object context. Okay, so I could fix that by just going like this and be done with it. Right, say, okay, it inherits, it implements iContext. The only problem with that is if I make a modification of the model, I'm using the T4 code generation, that will go away because this is generated code. So instead of doing it there, and this may look familiar to some of you, what I want to do is modify, or should I say remodify, because you saw me unmodify it, the template itself. So I found the place where I'm telling the template to, you know, add this inheritance to the object context. So I'll now say also inherit from I context. Pair programming. Okay. Now, it's still going to fail. All right. And here's the reason is because when I defined the I context, I said I want to return I object sets. And if we look at the context down here, it's still returning object set. So see, it's unhappy about those also. This needs to be an do you see it says the type should be an I object set? Okay, that's its issue there. So I'll go here to where I have the object set. I have the private variable and the public property. So there's one of them and there's the other one. Now I'll save the template, and this should have gotten updated. There it is. So there's iContext, and it's also returning iObject sets. Okay, so there's a little customization of the template. Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. So the nomenclature that's being used here, right, is probably a little too general, right? Having a repository class just called repository and having the iContext interface just called iContext is fine for a demo, but the truth is, right, this is obviously too general sounding. So what we really have here is we have sort of a talk repository or a session repository, whatever in God's name you want to call it, right? In which case, this is probably not just iContext, but probably the iTalk context or the iSession context or whatever the repository wants to match up with, right? So the difference here is, right, that what you're saying, I think, is absolutely right, right? The other repository classes, which have different interface implementations, right, and different dependencies on different contexts being passed in, are going to need more specific names for these things, right? But you bring up a very good point, right, which is that these interfaces are stated more in probably too general terms for an actual application, right? This is not really just an iContext interface. It's a
context.
No, actually, believe it or not, you the compiler will prevent that. Right? If you pass the wrong one in, then what it's going to say is, sorry, the thing you passed in doesn't satisfy the constructor requirement on the repository. It must be, let's say it's an italk context, you try to pass in an iperson context, right? The compiler will blow up on you because you won't even be able to build
it. The other thing, I'm not sure if this is also something you're aiming at, but my interface defines this contract that I have to have, in this particular interface, I have to have talks and speakers and rooms. So anything that is an iContext will have talks and speakers and rooms by the contract of the interface. I'm not sure if that's where you were going with the question. Oh, no. I made it up. It came out of my imagination.
Yeah.
Got it. Oh, like iCollection. Okay.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So then moving on. So now this line of code is happy, right? It's happy. It likes the conference entities because that is now an iContext. So I can go ahead now and return a view of repository. Oops. I want the talk. So repository get all talks. It's a property, not a method. It's a method, not a property. I'll let the compiler tell me.
That should work.
Yeah, that'll work. Okay. So that's really it. And now I should be able to, go ahead and just run this, and it'll just work using the repository now. The longer it takes, the more I know it's going to work. Okay, so now I was definitely going through the repository, and I could, you know, debug through it in steps so you could see, but I think just because of the time, I'll just move on. So you get that worked. That wasn't a dog and pony show. I really am using the repository, and it really is doing what I said. But for those of you who have never done any of that before, just that little shift, did that make sense? I'm going to that? Okay, great. So it sounded like a yes is everywhere. All right. So then now what I want to do is just flip over to a bigger application there.
So the other thing to pay attention to, right, as Julie opens up the other solution, is you notice what it literally started out as two lines of code and it ended up as two lines of code, right? Now obviously there were several others. We had to declare an iObject set, or I'm sorry, an iContext. We had to define that. We had to go in and modify the templates a little bit, right? But the point is that the code you ended up with beforehand and the code you ended up with afterwards, it's not another 900 lines of code, right? It's just a different way of thinking about the level of abstraction that you introduce in terms of whenever you have a dependency, right? When you have a constructor argument like that, you're basically saying, I cannot have the thing that I'm trying to build without at least another one of these things, right? So you better be really, really sure that you're ready to take a dependency on another one of those things. So when you pass in constructor arguments like that, you're saying I can't build the first thing without an instance of the second thing. That's a hard dependency. I literally cannot new up one of these without another one of these things. So when you take dependencies like that in your code, you really want to do that with an abstraction in there which allows you to be as flexible as possible, because it's, you know, there's one level of inflexibility that is I'm adding a constructor argument, but there's ways to mitigate that by passing around things like interfaces rather than things like concrete types, so that you're saying, yeah, okay, sure, I need this in order to create this because it's a constructor dependency, but in the end, I want to be able to substitute other things in there. So you're taking the dependency, but you're loosening it just ever so slightly. Yeah. So the way that works, right, is that the context that Julie's passing in, I'm sorry, right, so the question is, how is the connection made, if we're passing in an interface, how is the connection made between the repository and the actual object context at runtime, right? The answer to that is right here, right? Julie's satisfying the dependency on the repository's constructor of having to pass in an iContext by passing in, and here we are in the real MVC app, right?
This don't is
the real
thing, through it.
Right? She's passing the actual implementation of the context, the entity framework implementation of the context.
Does that answer your question? Okay, great. All right, so let's flip over to the other solution. There's a whole bunch of stuff to show you here. So the first thing I want to do is show you, I like looking at this one better, I've broken things apart a little more. For example, I have my interface sitting here in its own little project. There's the iContext interface. The repositories, I have a bunch of different repositories now. So now I'm moving into having these aggregate root repositories instead of just having everything in one place. So I have logic for related to the customer in the customer repository. I even have, here's some update logic. Now, take a look at this update logic. And remember, I'm now working with an iContext, not a real entity, like a real object context. I'm just working with an iContext. And I'm also in a very disconnected state now, right, because I've got a lot of separation. And I can't be sure. I could use this repository in a service. I could use it in a WPF application. I could use it in a website, right? I can use it anywhere I want. Therefore, I do not want to code in any dependencies on having a long-running context. So I'm always thinking in terms of being disconnected now, all right? So here's an example. If I make a change to a customer in my application, I want to tell the repository, go ahead and update this. Now, update is very different than go save these changes to the database. I'm just having the repository be in charge of what to do with this entity, okay? So in the context of my repository, what I'm doing is I'm passing in, I actually have, in this case, I've designed it so that these are my expectations. I'm passing in an original version of an entity and a modified version of the entity, and I have specific logic to take care of that. But I'm not calling save changes in here. I'm just letting the context know what to do with this, letting the context know about this update, okay? I'm not dealing with a lot of the other state stuff here. I'm just passing it in saying, I just want you to know this is something that's going to be updated. Now, this may not be the way you would architect it, but this is my, he's gone, no, definitely
not.
No,
so there are a couple of good things going on here, right? So we're a couple of things, right? The first thing is it's a two-line method. I love two-line methods because how much can go wrong in two lines of code, right? So the point here is, right, that this one method, update, is responsible for just one thing, right? We take the original entity and attach it back to the context, and then we simply ask the context to go on ahead and update the change tracking by comparing the original to the new, right? So first of all, it's short, and secondly, right, it's only got one responsibility. Right? We're not jumping in and out of this, all kinds of different framework classes here and doing 1,000 different things. It might be odd, right? And this is, again, it comes down to convention, right, in your team when you're consuming the code. It might be odd for an update on the repository to actually do an implicit save, right? What if I'm in a unit of work, right? I'm not really ready to push the changes back to the database yet. All I really want to do is I'm at the point in the workflow where I'm ready to indicate to the repository I've got an updated customer, right? The choice of when to push that back to the database is an entirely separate logical operation, right, with an entirely separate timeline. So this kind of approach here is actually very good in that it allows us to do all of that.
So I just want to make sure you understand this is my own method. This is not anything to do with the entity framework. It's not in there. It's my own method. And we can't take the time to really drill through this. You can get this and play with it at will, but I just wanted to point these out. I'm also, all of my repositories are inheriting from an entity repository. Right? So my entity repository just gives me a contract that says any of my repository, when I create a repository, it needs to have an add, it needs to have an attach, it needs to have a delete, it needs to have a method to return all, it needs to have a method to return, to enable me to get by ID. Right? So this, again, simple, but these are the basics. So I make sure that all of my repositories do these things. And this has nothing to do with entity framework. It doesn't matter what's on the back end. This is just these are the basic things I want to be doing, however I'm doing it. Whatever. This is persistent ignorant. It doesn't care, right? It won't care even when I put a context in there, it won't care, because the context back in the back end is going to define how it's all persisted. So that's my iEntity repository. So the other ones look essentially the same. And with one big difference in addition to the iEntity repository, one big difference from what we saw in the little MVC application. I've now introduced a unit of work. In the previous application, I had a constructor where I passed in an I context. Now I have a couple of constructors. I also have the option of passing in a unit of work. Unit of work, again, is my own class that I defined. It is right here. And in a unit of work, manages kind of that overall, okay, when is it time to save, right? That's the basics of it. So I could pass in a unit of work and then let the unit of work provide a context and be in charge of that. And that's how my applications are working. I have a reservation repository. Again, you know, it implements all the things that iRepository says that I have to, iEntity repository says that I have to. And it also has some additional methods in it, okay? And this is an architectural choice. In a highly architected application, and you're doing solid design and all this, you would say, well, all these extra things, they go somewhere else. But for here, this is perfect, you know, this is okay, just to give you an idea that we've got a bunch of other logic in here. So those are my repositories and the unit of work. My iContext is defined up here. I also have brought in the POCO state assembly that we saw in the disconnected. So I'm using the state objects, but that's not really important for the whole repository, but I just wanted you to see why that's there. Now, the thing that I'm doing that's of big interest to me here is I have a bunch of tests. So here's a test project. It has some tests against the actual tests that will actually hit the database. So for me, those are integration tests because they actually test how my infrastructure works with other things. And then I also have some tests in here that are very specifically unit tests. They're testing logic in my reservation repository. Okay? And so here's a really good example. Here's an example that we're going to focus on. But you'll see in this example, I'm spinning up that reservation repository, and I'm passing in an I context. But I'm not passing in the context that you've seen. I'm passing in another context. It's called fake context. That's over here. The fake context is my very own class I created. It's not part of Entity Framework. And guess what? It implements my iContext interface. So I made sure that it follows the contract of the implementation. It returns all of the things that this iContext requires. And then when it's time to, for example, return the context, rather than going to the database, to get those contexts, let's not look at contexts. I've got some inheritance going on here, so it gets a little confusing. Let's look at trips. No, let's look at reservations, because it's reservations. Okay, so when it's time to return an I object set of reservations, rather than going to hit the database, I'm going to call this little internal method. It's in the same class. And all I'm doing is creating a bunch of in-memory objects. And then I'm returning that. So that's what the fake context does. The fake context, rather than hitting the actual database, it just creates in-memory objects so that I'm going to be able to write unit tests against the reservation repository without hitting the database. Okay? Now, there's places where you can do unit tests where this doesn't even matter. For example, you want to make sure that the last name field of a person, if somebody's entering a last name field, that it's not greater than 50 characters, right? That's not something that's ever going to hit a database. So it's never been a problem with Entity Framework to do a unit test like that, where the test, you know, is able to stay right within the unit of the class that it's testing without going out and hitting some other framework, like hitting a database or doing something that interacts with the Entity Framework APIs, right? That actually stays right within the class. However, I have a method in the reservation repository that does complicate things when I just want to test something related to my method without hitting the database. Okay? So here's the method, get reservations for customer, and I have some validation code. My validation code just checks to make sure that I've got a valid ID coming in. Right, it has a value because it could be, it's nullable, and that the value is actually be greater than zero. But my validation says it has to be greater than one. Right, that's my validation code. So if I want to test this, I could write a test that makes sure that if I pass it a bad value, it throws an error. That's actually an easy test to write, and I've got that test over here. This is a test passing ID of zero to get reservations for customer throws. Right? That's what I want it to do. I'm going to pass bad data in, and I want to make sure that it throws an exception. That means that it's doing its job, right? It's throwing an exception because I'm passing in bad data. So that's an easy test for me, because what happens is it comes here, it hits the it says this is wrong, it has an exception, and it throws the exception. And it never gets here. But now I want to do the other test. Okay, I know that it throws when I pass bad data, but I also want to make sure it does its job when I pass good data. This is, you know, how you write unit tests, right? You want to test all these different scenarios. So here's the problem with Entity Framework. If I didn't have my fakes and all this setup that we've created, what would happen is I want to test something good, right? So I pass in a good ID. It comes here, it says, yeah, it has a value, yeah, the value is greater than one, and then it comes to this next line of code and goes into the database and executes the query, right? Now, my test had nothing to do about query execution or hitting the database or does the entity, you know, an object context do what it's supposed to do or does this include work or does toList work? The test that I wanted to test was, does my validation code work? Right? Do you see the problem here? I can't have my test tell the method, okay, but if it's good, then don't do that next line of code because I don't want you to hit the database. Right? There's no way for me to really do that. So this is why I have the fakes. If I use the fake, if I pass in, this is the one that tests for bad. This is the one that tests that a good one does its job and doesn't throw an exception. So I'm spinning up a fake context, right? It implements I context, so that's good. I pass it into the reservation repository, and I'm able to test that method, to test that logic, and it will never hit the database. Right? This is a really interesting, it's a small sample, but it's a really interesting sample of where I have a method I want to test. I want to test some particular logic, and I'm trying to avoid that other code and that method that hits the database and executes the query because I don't care about that. And this is how I'm pulling it off. So there's a whole bunch of other tests in here. And I'm not going to run that. We just don't have time to go through it all. I mean, I certainly never plan to go through all of it anyway. But you'll have access to this code, and you really can start plugging through it. What I can do is at least show you that, the unit tests all. I get the green, right? So this does all work. So all the infrastructure I've set up does work. Green, 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 green. So I've got all these tests, and everything's working. And it would be, interesting to open up the profiler and show you, a SQL profiler and show you I'm never hitting the database and I'm getting all, so I'm able to build all these tests for my logic. The other thing, especially for people like me, is, you know, I've never tested before. I'm interested in starting to learn how to write unit tests and everything. That's really great. But still, like, but what about the UI? Like, I've never done that. I just want to make sure it still works in my real application. A test is not my real application, right? And I've really gotten to the point where I can write tests first and, like, wait months before I write a UI. I'm comfortable with that now. It took me a while to get there. But just for the sake of you, I've actually taken one of the unit tests, the code that was in the unit test, and I put it in a console app just to show it. You know, here's a UI. It actually still works in the UI. Now, the interesting about this console application is I pointed out earlier that with the new repositories, I have two constructors. One constructor I can pass in a unit of work, but that's not what I wanted to point out. This is the important thing I wanted to point out. I want to go back to that unit of work class. There's two constructors for the unit of work. One of them is just spin up a new unit of work, and the other one I pass in a context. If I don't pass in a context, the default behavior is that it's going to create the real context, the BA entities context that inherits from object context and literally hits the database. That's the real context. So if I don't pass in a context, that's its default behavior. But I can always pass in an I context, whether it's the real context or fake context or some other context that implements I context. So if we go back to the program, our UI, I don't want to get the fake data. I want a real, this is my real application. So I'm instantiating the unit of work, and notice I'm not passing in any context. That means it's going to default to creating the real context that hits the database. Okay? Then I take that unit of work and I pass it into my repository and I call some code and I write some data out and I make some changes and I call unit of work save. And then I have this little bit of code that just shows me what I do. What I was doing originally was I created a new reservation, so I counted the reservations. And then after I did the save, I counted how many reservations I really have. Nope, that's what I did in the unit test. Over here, I'm just spitting out the ID that the database generated, which proves to me I hit the database. It created a new reservation and gave me back a new ID. That's right, I made that change for the console app. So I'll just run this console app, and, you know, it went to the database, it got all this information, and it also, the save changes worked, and that's the new ID that the database generated and sent back to me. So it definitely, definitely works. So that is a quick run through with the goal of, for people who are very familiar with unit testing and repositories and everything, but have never seen them in the scope of using them with Entity Framework, hopefully that gives you some ideas of how you would architect that. And then for people who are very new to this stuff, just getting a glimpse of, you know, how all of these pieces fit together, and, you know, you'd take some more time to, well, this is why it's not going. Yeah? It takes some more time to learn about it, so you've gotten a look at it. And, you know, and for those people who are new to doing all this stuff, whether you're new to Entity Framework, but especially new to, like, unit testing and repositories and all this architecture, I just want to say, if I can do it, you can do it. Right? This really was daunting to me, really, really daunting to me. And I'm like, I get it. It took me some time, but I get it. I saw a hand back here. I can't hear you well.
Let's see, in your unit of work, you have a multi, you have to share into multiple data sets.
Okay, multiple databases, which means you've got multiple contexts. Okay. Didn't I have this conversation with somebody today? Somebody had a similar question about multiple databases and context. Yeah.
No, what you'd have to do is in Julie's implementation of her unit of work, she's got a single context property that she injects into it, right? She's got her I context in the constructor.
For one context.
So what you'd have to do in that situation, I want to say that context, but that's obviously a problem to say here. So in that situation, what you'd end up having to do is you'd have to have your unit of work hang on to multiple contexts. And then when you commit save, for example, in the unit of work, you'd have to loop through each one of them and call context.save changes on each one of them. But they're not going to happen in the context of a single database transaction, right? Because each one of those calls to save changes on the actual underlying context is a separate database transaction. So what you need is, right, if you think about it for a second, what you need to do at that point within your unit of work is if you start treating a unit of work behavior, right, a save, for example, atomically, then you need compensating logic in the rollback if you're going to roll back that business transaction. Right, it's different than the kind of compensation that, you know, the database transaction will just take care of it for you, right? In this case, because the unit of work doesn't represent a database transaction, but it represents an atomic business operation, it's on you to define what that business operation is, and it's on you to define what that business operation is when you unwind it or compensate for it as well, right? So, for example, if you loop through, you know, let's say your unit of work hangs on to 10 contexts, and when you call unit of work.save, you're going to go for each context in context, call save changes, right? If number 3 of 10 comes back with, sorry, couldn't commit, it's up to you to go back and compensate for the first two that were successful, right? Because those transactions have already closed, right? They've already been committed to the database, right? So it's up to you to unwind them in some way, either by, you know, again, some kind of compensating business logic or some kind of compensating database logic. Across multiple databases?
Maybe not across multiple databases, but in the bus, in a model, in the physical work model, where would you put transactions for what would you even?
So you can, right? Plenty of people have unit of work implementations that do allow for external control of transaction scope, let's call it, right? And usually that would be a responsibility that I would allocate to the unit of work. So you need, like, for example, right, Julie's got a unit of work.save, right? Plenty of unit of work have unit of work.begin transaction, unit of work.commit, unit of work.rollback. You know, essentially you're reproducing the transaction API. But within the unit of work, it's up to you in terms of obviously what happens when those methods are called, right? The simple use case is the unit of work.begin transaction, unit of work.commit, right? And obviously commit has an implicit save, right? The challenge is the unit of work.rollback. Right, or what you do in the catch block of the transaction commit in your unit of work. But plenty of people have unit of work units of work that are transaction aware. It's a very common use pattern, yes. Yeah. Right. Yep. Yep. So, yep. Right. So the answer to that question is that effective unit testing, whether it's involving a database or not involving a database, ultimately really comes down to two things, effective isolation and state management, right? Because once you get those two things, then you get reproducibility, and that's the third most important thing about a unit test, right? So in the case of database-dependent testing, right, it would definitely be necessary that in addition to Julie's unit tests, that are fully isolated and not talking to the database, she would need integration tests to actually verify that the queries are actually working for real, right? So the where clause is not forgotten in your case, right? So there's a whole series of frameworks and libraries and tools that enable you to effectively populate the database before a unit test and then tear down the database after the unit test. They're well beyond sort of the scope of this talk, of course, but there are a number of open source .NET utilities for this. It happens just by chance. I actually built one myself called NDB Unit, which essentially preloads data stored in .NET data sets, pushes it into your database before the unit test, and rips it back out when it's done. Because in essence, right, you need that for the where clause in the select case, but if you think about it for a minute, you also need it for your inserts, your updates, your deletes, and so on, right? All of that is destructive to data, of course. So you need the ability to manage state, which is about preloading an expected set of records into the database before the test fires, and then asserting that what happened to those records is really what you expected to have happen. In the case of a select, it's easy. You're going to query and make sure you really get back the three records you expected. In the case of a delete, it's a little harder because you need to make sure the record's missing, right? But it's the same kind of process, right? So that's one of the reasons why we say, right, all right, then. Is that like some comment on my talk? In the context of database-dependent code, right, it's one thing to go the extra mile and introduce abstractions as we did here in order to better isolate things so you can run true unit tests isolated from the database, but there are very few people that are into unit testing that would argue that you do not also need to do the integration test, where the code that actually accesses the database is exercised by actually accessing the database, right? So in Julie's case, she wanted to test her validation logic. Does the customer have a valid ID? It doesn't involve the database, but the code under test needs to talk to the database to do that, right?
Hello.
Right? So the code under test needs to talk to the database in order to do that. She needs a way to isolate that. So in that case, that's a good use of that abstraction to insert her own fake context and not really talk to the database. But she needs to also exercise that exact same method on the repository for real, talking to the database to make sure it really does return the three objects she expects, for example, right? Some of this, by the way, is actually doable in the context of what used to be called Data Dude, right? The Data Dude add-in for Visual Studio 2008, which was the database developer edition of back when there were different all these different products used for Visual Studio 2008. In 2010, there are some tools to help you manage database state, so you can sort of Google around for that. But if you search, you'll find a number of these things that are essentially about open source tooling and frameworks for .NET that basically make it really easy for you to manage and maintain these things. As I say, you know, just one I happen to be very familiar with because I was part of the team that built it is NDB Unit, which, as I say, you can just go to it's on Google Code. You can check it out. It's not a sales pitch, just an answer. Yeah. Not really. You can to a degree, right? But because you're in charge of the methods, right? Those methods on the object context are the result of those, you know, T4 templates firing, right? So when you say, you know, the method delete customers, for example, right? The body of that method is produced on the object context as a result of that T4 template. If you wanted to put code in there, right, to make sure that, you know, for example, you inspect the, you know, in the case of a link query, you inspect something else, right, before it goes on its way, you're perfectly welcome to. I would probably not argue that that's the right place to do that, but you could probably get away with it that way. Any other questions before we, I don't know, hand out mice and something else? No? No more questions? All right. Hey, crew. Team, hello. Let's get some stuff away and get out of here. I know I want to get out of here. Very nice. I love it.
I'm going to stop the recording.
Oh, that seems fair.
It's a comment first, but you finish the report. Okay. And a little complication. My parents live in Binghamton. They're actually here and seeing a doctor. And my mom has just finished with her appointment. They're like, where are you? We thought you were going to be here at 6.